This is Barron's Live. Each weekday, we bring you live conversations from our newsrooms about what's moving the market right now. On this podcast, we take you inside those conversations, the stories, the ideas, and the stocks to watch so you can invest smarter. Now, let's dial in.
Good afternoon or good morning. I'm Quentin Futrell, the Managing Editor for Personal Finance at MarketWatch. Together here with me today, I have Emma Aukerman, a reporter for MarketWatch, and also Adam Perdue, who is a research economist at Texas A&M University's Real Estate Research Center. Hi, Emma. Hi, Adam. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. So we called the event today the new housing crisis, and we're going to explain why, and we're going to take questions from viewers. But look, there is a crisis for millions of Americans who want to buy a home. And that, as you may be or may not be aware, is an affordability crisis and also a supply crisis. There's a real shortage of homes being built and available for sale at the moment. But you know what? Let's start with the good news for a change. Although there was a slight increase in foreclosures after the pandemic-related moratoria on rents and mortgage payments wound down, foreclosures overall remain low. And that's one big important difference between today and what we experienced before the 2008 housing crisis and crash, as it was then. The New York Fed says that 68% of newly originated mortgage debt in the first quarter of 2021 went to borrowers with credit scores over 760. So that was, you know, during the real peak, among one of the peaks of the great house buying frenzy that happened during the pandemic. Subprime mortgages remain effectively non-existent. That's what Fed researchers said. So now I'm moving to the big however. However, total housing inventory nationwide at the end of March was down 9.5% at something like 950,000 units from a year ago when it stood at over 1 million. So while there may not be a housing bubble like there was in 2008, and I know that's already one question that somebody has, supply issues are putting pressure on buyers, particularly first-time buyers. At least one analyst has said that buyers are, quote, scraping the bottom of the barrel. On Wednesday, construction of new houses fell slightly in April for the second month in a row. And that suggests that rising mortgage rates, record home prices, and the high cost of building materials are all starting to take effect. And that affects supply, and it affects the amount of money, of course, you're going to pay for a home. So this lack of supply can be seen in the latest Fed data as well. Mortgage balances on consumer debt credit reports increased by $250 billion to $11.1 trillion during the first quarter of the year. So the Fed said mortgage originations declined from historically high volume seen in 2021. And that also reflects an unwinding in the demand for refinancing. Fewer people are refinancing. Fewer homeowners may be looking to sell, especially if they can't find a suitable replacement home. So for those who are making lateral moves or downsizing, it may be easier. So I wanted to come first of all to Emma, our reporter here at MarketWatch. The pandemic boom in home sales is over, seems. Mortgage rates have soared to the highest level since 2009 as the Fed puts pressure on the housing market with its rate hikes. The last time mortgage rates, Emma, were this high, Barack Obama was just months into his first term as president, and we were in the depths of the Great Recession. So on Monday, the White House released a plan to tackle the nation's housing shortage, Emma. So what exactly did that say?
Right. So the Biden administration basically recognizing that by some estimates, we're short millions of homes necessary to meet demand, in, for one part, wants to incentivize cities to peel back exclusionary zoning rules. So these are sort of the baked-in laws that can make it incredibly difficult to conduct construction across the country. The idea here being pretty simple, that if you increase construction, you increase supply, and over time, you lower prices. So for one, jurisdictions that have already reformed zoning to either favor density or rural Main Street revitalization, they get higher scores when applying for grants for funding from last year's infrastructure bill, basically meaning they leave money on the table if they leave really restrictive zoning laws in place. The White House also wants to incentivize the construction of what some might consider non-traditional forms of housing, but can also be cheaper and quicker to construct, that being manufactured housing, accessory dwelling units, which some folks call granny flats. Specifically, the Biden administration said it was interested in addressing the lack of attractive, low-cost financing options for these kind of housing, this sort of housing structure. And that's really interesting to some advocates who had particularly pointed out that this entrance into manufactured housing and expression of interest in manufactured housing is sort of new and very appealing. That being said, there is a lot of this that hinges on congressional funding. That is also something that affordable housing advocates were quick to point out that could kind of stymie the Biden administration's efforts. There was $170 billion in Build Back Better, the stalled legislation to address affordable housing, which was something that advocates and progressive Democrats were really excited about. That's sort of been off the table ever since Senator Joe Manchin withdrew his support for Build Back Better in December.
Right. The National Association of Realtors said that U.S. home ownership rate has surged, during the pandemic. But it says that the home ownership rate for Black Americans is somewhere around 43%, Emma, versus 72% for white Americans and 62% almost for Asian Americans and Hispanic Americans. So is this the gap the White House is attempting to bridge with this announcement that came out on Monday?
Sure. I mean, anything to address housing affordability and put homeownership more in reach for regular Americans could effectively be considered a racial justice measure. But it's important to note that when we're talking about the racial homeownership gap, we are talking about a mammoth, monumental problem. And with the Biden administration's plan, we're sort of talking about incremental, albeit important changes. So with the National Realtors Association of Realtors data, it's important to note that Black homeownership is actually slightly lower than it was a decade ago. Even the white Americans, Asian Americans, Hispanic Americans, they've all seen homeownership reach new highs in the past decade. The NAR's analysis also noted that half of homes listed for sale are affordable to people making about $100,000 a year. That's a threshold that about 35% of white Americans meet, but only 20% of Black Americans meet. So there's a fundamental affordability problem there that, while it can be addressed by and will be addressed by increasing availability of homes, we're talking about something far more structural here. It's also worth talking about the fact that with rents increasing, Black Americans are more likely to spend more than half of their incomes on rent already. That means that they're able to save less for a down payment. So when we're talking about addressing the racial housing or homeownership gap, oftentimes we're talking about addressing not just availability or supply of homes, but far more structural issues like limiting debt burden on Black households, closing income gaps, peeling back restrictive zoning laws, and addressing discrimination in the home buying process itself.
Right. Adam, Freddie Mac has said that the U.S. housing market is 3.8 million single-family homes short of what is needed to meet the country's demand. It's a lot of homes. What are the short and long-term headwinds that face buyers? Now, we know there's the supply crisis, but what other challenges are buyers facing right now?
All right. So, I mean, we've already brought up this long-term kind of question a couple of times here, and that is this 3.8 million home shortage is also kind of a 3.8 million home shortage, specifically where people want to live, which is in our growing and wealthier metropolitan areas. And as Him has already said a couple of times, a lot of this is based on zoning. And so over this long term, right, there are limitations on the housing that is allowed to build. We have increased housing unaffordability in general by specifically targeting the ability of people to build affordable housing. We across the country, all of our major metropolitan areas, well, this is a municipal level problem, but all of our municipal local governments, they restrict the building. They require that you have excess lot sizes. They require that you have excess parking. They require setbacks. They limit your ability to build more housing on a given amount of land. And that's this long-term issue has prevented people from being able to move where they want. And more housing in more locations in metropolitan areas that we see have increasing productivity, increasing income. And so this is that kind of long-term situation that Freddie Mac is kind of referencing with the 3.8 million. A lot of what we're talking about today, though, is just a short-term situation that has just compounded upon that. What we've seen during this COVID era here is a massive increase in housing demand. The census has just reported vacancy rates have fallen significantly. This is people responding both to COVID and not necessarily wanting to live with as many people or as many people in a small space, and deciding that instead of having a roommate and living in a two-bedroom, both of those guys are going to go to two separate one-bedroom. But since we're working from home, both of those people might be moving out into two separate two-bedrooms so that you can have your work-from-home office. Or we had couples who are maybe wanting more space for single family homes to get separation from everybody else in their apartment complexes. So we've seen this demand that is kind of a confluence of COVID and work from home has increased there. And then supply has been limited because our builders have been facing the same kind of shortfalls, supply constraints that you've heard about in the rest of the economy. They've been facing that kind of thing. So while they've permitted and started significantly more houses in response to these increases in demand, they just haven't been able to see the completion rate go up in the same kind of proportion. Then plus, right, prices have increased over the last 2 years because the Fed kind of, you can think of it as gifted people who managed to keep their jobs, right, which again is the systematic issues that Inman was talking about. Those people that have been relatively well off, right, are also relatively capable of working from home, so they kept their jobs. And then they were gifted with an extra 17% purchasing power by the cuts in the rates by the Fed. And so we've seen prices increase. And now if you weren't able to capture that over the last 2 years, we are facing both those higher prices and rates are now reversing and are up to 5.3%. And so then now if you're trying to get into the market today, we have this higher prices, we have higher rates on your mortgage rates, and it's really constraining people's ability to enter in the market today.
Right. Thanks. Thanks a lot, Adam. I wanted to also remind the audience to submit questions, but we already have quite a few. And I wanted to just quickly turn to one. We have a question here from Morgan, who asks, what percentage of housing purchases are private equity rental investments? Well, we do know that, you know, this has been on the increase. Real estate investors, according to real estate brokerage Redfin, bought a record of 18.4% of the homes that were sold in the U.S. during the fourth quarter of last year, Morgan. So that's up from 12.6% a year earlier and a revised rate of 17.4% in the third quarter. So 18.4%, you know, that's a lot of presumably homes that are being flipped or rented out. I mean, that's obviously pushing, you know, people, you know, consumers out of the market. Morgan also asks what percentage of homes are second homes for people. You may not be surprised to know, Morgan, that the share of second homes soared by over 80%, according to some estimates, during the pandemic as people sought to flee cities and work remotely. Second home transactions averaged a 3.8% quarterly market share of all mortgage rate locks, according to the Pacaso second term market report. But that that was, you know, over the last couple of years, that 3.8% quarterly market share, but that increased to 4.3% market share last summer. So again, more people buying second homes, to cut your to cut a long story short. So Morgan also asks, what share of homes were all cash buyers? Another good question. Nearly one third of US home purchases were paid for with all cash, Redfin found. That seems like an awful lot of homes, up from 25% during all of 2020. And that's the largest share since 2014. When over 30% of homes were purchased with all cash. That seems like an awful lot of homes. But that shows, if accurate, that shows the kind of competition out there for house hunters, right? If you're buying, bidding on a house, and the other fellow is an all cash buyer, and I'm the seller, I'm thinking, you know, this guy's mortgage approval might not go through. It's a safer bet. It's really tough to bid against an all cash buyer. And as I said, like, remote work has obviously played a big part in the housing increase. You know, many fortunate people, not everybody, in actually a smaller percentage than you might care to think, judging by the news media, but some people have been fortunate enough to have the freedom to live wherever they choose during the pandemic. And economists at the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco and the University of California, San Diego, just this week released a paper that showed that the shift to remote work explains, wait for this, over one half of the nearly 24% national house price increase between 2019 and November 2021. So that remote work shift has really had an enormous impact on house prices. They concluded that our results imply a fundamentals-based explanation for the recent increases in housing costs over speculation or financial factors, and that the evolution of remote work is likely to have large effects on the future path of house prices and inflation. Look, if people go back to the office, if there is a return to normal over the next 2 years, expect to see some of those increases in those markets, the secondary markets, you know, places where people have moved out to in the suburbs of New York and Florida and other secondary markets. Expect to see some kind of reversal, I would imagine, if there is. But of course, there's also a lot of people who are resisting going back to the office. Those, again, who have been lucky enough to be able to do that during the pandemic. There are many, many people in the services industry, particularly, who have not got that luxury. Always worth noting. Emma, what's happening with renters 2 years into the pandemic? We have a question, another question from a reader here, Joseph, who asks, what's the impact of these trends on the rental market? Renters in big metropolitan areas initially, some of them anyway, benefited from the exodus from the big cities, but that migration didn't affect everybody equally, right?
Right. I mean, to put it scientifically, the rental market is bananas right now. So essentially, you might be being punished if you live in one of the more beautiful pockets of America. We have seen really high rent increases in places like Ketchum and Idaho's Sun Valley, parts of Florida, also Lake Tahoe. And one impact that this is having is it's essentially making it more difficult for the workforces there that sort of keep the towns running, that being, you know, your paramedics, your law enforcement officers, your nurses. These are people who might find it more difficult to live in these communities that are seeing a sudden huge bump in population. So I know that that's something that folks are really concerned about and trying to focus on. As far as rent across the country, investors have been really keen on pouring cash into, again, those really beautiful places in the Sun Belt. So we're seeing rent increases in Phoenix, Albuquerque, Austin, Texas, and also some really high increases in places like Miami. The logic here is fairly simple. Investors might be seeing, you know, that people are moving into these places, that they could experience a huge population increase, and there's a lot of money to be made. The sort of real impact that that has on the ground is that, at least according to Redfin, in March, rents were up, I think, 17%. Year over year. And while that might not sound like a gigantic increase, just a reminder, you know, that translates to nearly $300 a month increase for the families that are caught in the middle of this crisis. That is going to have a particularly hard impact on low to moderate income folks who might not have a lot of money to share. And going back to, you know, both of your points on people, you know, potentially having difficulty buying homes too, it's important to remember that people who might have bought homes in a less bananas market are staying renters, which means that there's a greater demand for rentals as well.
Right. Thanks. Thanks so much, Emma. I think, you know, that also speaks to the rental market and the investors, people buying second homes, perhaps to rent out, perhaps to live in. There's a connection between all of those trends, circling back to Morgan's question. But we have a question here, Emma, from Ryan, slightly different. How much of a role has the build to rent industry had on the accessibility and affordability of housing for millennials and Gen Z? Are there any political headwinds yet for the institutional build to rent and single family rental asset holders?
Yeah, so this is a great question, but like most things, it sort of depends on who you ask. So of course, build to rents are trending upward and creating opportunities for people who might not traditionally expect to become homeowners, especially in this housing market, that being, you know, in large part, millennial homeowners or potential millennial homeowners and Gen Z renters. And of course, you know, some real estate developers say that this will lower costs because in part it increases availability, which is a good thing. But it's also important to note that build to rent is still a relatively small share of new construction, even though it's a really hot part of the market right now. And I think the concerns about political headwinds are valid. Of course, you know, given the level of evictions that we saw from some Wall Street firms in the pandemic and the skepticism around firms that jumped into properties for rent post 2008, we saw some politicians, you know, sort of drawing more attention to this specific kind of investor. And it's also important to note, too, that with the Biden administration's plan that we talked about that was announced on Monday, there was a specific call out there about trying to push properties where possible into the hands of typical homeowners rather than institutional investors. And with that kind of language coming out from the feds, it's sort of easy to imagine a world in which there's a little bit more skepticism toward institutional investors. And I think another part of this that can be complicated as well is with build to rent, you know, there's sort of a baked in expectation there that you are accepting a world where fewer people have the opportunity to own. And for some people, that's totally reasonable. Owning a home might not be the most economical option, particularly in cities where homeownership is becoming far too expensive. But that's not always the most politically popular thing to say as well, that fewer people can expect to become homeowners in the future, especially when homeownership is one of the number one wealth builders in America. You do have to ask, where is the replacement wealth creation going to come from for those folks?
Right. And, you know, as you say, Emma, some housing markets are hot, particularly places like California, places in Florida. And you might have read about a 3-bedroom, 2-bathroom, mid-century modern home in El Cerrito, California, which was built in 1963 and listed at $1.25 million. This just shows you how crazy the housing market is at the moment. It sold for $2.45 million, $1 million over the asking price. The realtor said it was a particularly sought after property because it was mid-century and it had the wraparound decks and et cetera. But those kinds of stories are both amazing and alarming. MarketWatch recently analyzed more than 5 years of monthly housing inventory data and created an interactive tool where anybody who's listening today or watching this this on the video, can search by county for the change in homes available for sale. So the reporters, the MarketWatch reporters in that piece, Katie Mariner, Eleanor Lace, and Jacob Passy, said El Paso, Texas, was one city that has seen a remarkable inventory crunch. The MarketWatch analysis, which focused mostly on larger real estate markets, found the biggest drops in housing listings over the last 5 years were Raleigh, North Carolina, Las Vegas, and of the 20 cities that have seen the number of homes available for sale plunge the most since 2017, nine of those 20 are located in, guess what state? Florida. So that's a really interesting interactive tool, and I would argue that it also points to that supply crisis that we're having right now in the housing market. Adam, in an earlier conversation I had with you, you mentioned that some secondary markets were among the hottest right now. What are you seeing?
I mean, besides the ones you've already mentioned, right? The people like to talk about Boise, Idaho, like the Idaho, Emma mentioned a couple in Idaho, right? Where we presume people are going for, the natural beauty of the Western Mountain regions. And we see a lot of talk lately about Austin, Texas. When you look across a lot of these secondary markets, it's very idiosyncratic. We're seeing growth by and large across the whole country. And those hot markets are just pop up everywhere, and month to month is changing. We can talk about a lot of different reasons why we're seeing that. There's a movement to the suburbs, which actually is kind of persistent, just because of the way cities grow. The suburbs are always going to grow faster. We had that kind of trend pretty much always. It was reinforced a little bit by COVID. Movement to Texas and Florida, and all of the municipalities around, so here in Texas, all our municipalities around our major metros, including Austin and San Antonio, Dallas, Fort Worth, and Houston, and up and down, just Florida in general. But Texas and Florida, actually typically beats us on net in-migration, year to year, but Texas every now and then hits the number one. And that's just a long-term trend that's been reinforced again. And there's secondary markets all across that, Texas and Florida, that pop up on the fastest growing list. There's kind of a blood sport here. We like to call 7 degrees from California here in Texas and, west of the Great Plains. We hear a lot of it too. California has been an out migration state for quite a while as the housing pressures continue to push people on affordability out of California. And so then that's a lot of what the talk is out of California, up and down, only up left to go there, Portland, Oregon, Seattle, and some of the secondary cities in Washington and Oregon, and then the mountain states, right, Las Vegas, as Californians move out of California. And again, that's a long-term trend that's just kind of been reinforced. And we're seeing this secondary markets and all of those different types of situations are just keep on popping up as some of the fastest pricing appreciation, population growth, all these other kind of issues that we've seen with the housing market right now.
Right. And as you say, the houses are still seeing a lot of pricing pressure, which might explain at least partly that bizarre San Francisco unicorn that sold $1 million over the asking price. Some housing markets are more stable than others. New York City homes, for the most part, caveat, tend to hold their prices, sort of a market unto its own. Places like Palm Springs, where I am now, has a somewhat more volatile housing market. Obviously many people moved here from the LA during the pandemic, driving up house prices. Obviously not all secondary housing markets are going to hold their value over time as we, see how the world changes again as we come out of the pandemic. A recent poll, I found this interesting, from Gallup, found that only 30% of Americans believe now is a good time to buy a house. It's the lowest level on record since Gallup began surveying Americans on this question beginning in 1978. And it's the first time less than 50% of people across the country thought it was a good time to buy and achieve that part of the American dream. But put another way, even at the height of the foreclosure crisis amid the Great Recession, at least 50% of Americans still thought it was right to purchase a home. But today, with home prices and mortgage rates raising, people are growing more concerned about taking the plunge. So that speaks again to a sort of the title of this event, you know, the new housing crisis, that is one of supply as well. And that brings me to another question from Daniel, who asks, is it a good time to buy now before prices keep escalating, or waiting for prices to drop? David, another audience member, asks, given the economic, health, and political turbulence we are currently experiencing, would you purchase a home right now, or would you wait until next year? So more than one person has asked the same question. The Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas recently warned of signs of a brewing, quote, this is a quote, brewing U.S. housing bubble, unquote. And that they said that in March. It cited shifts in disposable income, the cost of credit, and access to it, supply disruptions, rising labor, raw construction material costs, of course, are also among the economic reasons for the real house price gains, right? And analysts' predictions, David, vary. There's no real consensus that there was going to be a sudden, severe drop. Adam, you can correct me if I'm wrong on that, but supply, obviously, issues remain an issue. Gen Z, millennials want to buy homes. And as I said earlier, we don't have the subprime mortgage crisis looming like we did in 2008, but we still, caveat, have rumblings of a recession next year or 2024. Another caveat, we don't know how severe or how prolonged such a recession might be. Recessions can be very different. And we still, of course, have that global uncertainty with the war in Ukraine and the affordability problems as the rates keep going up or have gone up to date. But for what it's worth, Zillow last month released a revised forecast for house prices, predicting they will rise nearly 15% between March 2022 and March 2023. And that's down from a prediction of 17.8% it made in April. So house prices looks like they're still going up significantly. Adam, do you have an opinion on that?
Yeah. So here at the center, we're forecasting a little bit more of a fall in the growth rate than we're reporting here for Zillow. But we're still thinking it's going to be like price appreciation is still going to be positive, just significantly lower than it has been. I mean, just because of like what we talked about, the reversal of mortgage rates going back up to 5.3%. You know, one difference, you mentioned 2008 in one of the questions, right? And Emma likes to talk about rent a lot. And that's really the right way to take a look at it. And that's the big difference between now and 2008. In 2008, rents were relatively flat and were not providing any kind of support to the price increases that we saw in 2008. And then and rates were also flat. And so that was definitely a game of hoping that there was going to be somebody else, just crossing your fingers and hoping there was going to be somebody else later on, a year or two later, who was going to buy it for a higher price. This time, right, we're seeing these demand pressures are increasing rents, which support house prices. We had the rates that were lower, which is a big cause of the increase in prices, right? Your rental purchase price is really your rental versus your monthly cost to own of your mortgage. And so those have actually stayed relatively equivalent for people who have bought. And so now the real concern is now as mortgage rates have increased so much, right, that's kind of the pricing pressure, but we're still seeing rents increase. And so that's still putting upward pressure on the prices. So we're thinking over the, and we still have that bulk of uncompleted houses that are waiting to come onto the market. And so what we really think here at the center is that we'll see a more significant decline in the rate of appreciation. But note, it's still a rate of appreciation. We're not calling for falling prices. We didn't see significant falls in prices. I mean, we just don't ever really see that and persistent falls in prices. We see that recovery over 5 years or so. And this time, right, everybody's got had good rates that already own. Rents are still supportive of prices. And the big kink is the mortgage rates coming up the supply that we're just hoping that the builders will eventually be able to finish.
Right. So Daniel and David, the people who asked this question, if you're thinking of buying a home, I hope that gives you more clarity. It looks like prices are still going to increase, though maybe not at the levels that we have seen over the last 2 years. So Emma, what advice do you have for first time buyers, obviously facing a lot of challenges at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, not to be a total bummer, but I suppose that's in part the point of this conversation, but prepare to face disappointment on some level. I mean, Quentin, you mentioned this, but a lot of people right now who are entering the market for the first time, they're going to be staring down really deep-pocketed out-of-state investors, and that's not really going away anytime soon. And it's important to note because, and Quentin, you mentioned this as well, people... And investors are going to have the ability to overpay. That doesn't mean that the typical home buyer who's entering the market for the first time should be ready to overpay or willing to overpay by, you know, thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars. That being said, when talking about silver linings, because the political environment that we're in right now, it's not that policymakers don't recognize what's going on with the housing market. Do look into incentives that are available for first-time home buyers in your state. They exist. My home state of Michigan, I saw just opened up $10,000 in down payment assistance, depending on what zip code you live in. So, you know, do your research. You might be surprised at what sort of assistance programs are available for you in your city or state.
Right. Thanks, Emma. We're coming to very close to the close now. We have a lot of questions about should I pay above the market for the asking price if I'm going to live in the house for more than 5 years. I think our conversation about rising prices answers that. We have a lot of questions that are variations on that theme. I wanted to talk to Emma. Evictions are also on the rise in some markets, right? We can't forget that.
Yeah, sort of the canary in the coal mine, right, for rising homelessness or the potential for rising homelessness across the country. According to the Eviction Lab at Princeton University, which has been doing a fantastic job of tracking filings across the country, filings, which is, you know, evictions that are taken to court, not necessarily evictions that are carried out, are starting to reach or surpass pre-pandemic levels in some cities across the country. We're seeing evictions starting to rise in places like Travis County. That's where Austin is based. We're also seeing a rise in Denton County, where Fort Worth is based. Of course, you know, this is somewhat skewed toward the markets that have been doing evictions for some time during the pandemic. But what's concerning right now is that we're at the point of the pandemic where rental assistance isn't as readily available. Federal rental assistance probably going to be tapped out this summer. Eviction protections aren't as much in place. So while the eviction tsunami that was forecasted earlier in the pandemic didn't really come to fruition, that doesn't mean it's never coming at all. There are some folks who are very concerned that what we're going to see in these next few months is an increase in evictions in cities. It's important to note, too, that that has long-term ramifications. It's not a one-and-done type deal. Once folks are evicted, that can stay on the rental record for 7 years and make landlords less willing to rent to them. It's interesting to consider how many of these undesirable tenants are going to start to crop up and where they're going to go upon being evicted.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you, Emma. I think we're sort of running out of time. We have so many questions that we could not get to. So I'm sorry if we didn't answer your question. But I wanted to thank you both Emma Aukerman, Adam Perdue for joining me here today. And thank you to the audience for tuning in. Turn over to MarketWatch as well for our real estate coverage. And you may also find answers there. Team in DC and various parts of the country might be able to answer your questions if you take a look at the site. And please join us tomorrow about how working in retirement is being embraced by older adults and companies. My colleague, MarketWatch retirement editor Angela Moore, will speak with Richard Eisenberg, contributor to MarketWatch's Best New Ideas in Retirement, new package of which has just been released and will be continued to be released over the coming days. They're going to discuss the very tight labor market and how Zoom is helping baby boomers work the way they want to work. Thank you for listening. Stay healthy and please stay safe and have a wonderful rest of the day.